Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined, as always, by Frank Cagliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm doing great, David. Thank you very much. I'm still in Stockholm, where it's very snowy and cold. Or snowy and very cold, I should say.
We've had snow here, but now the snow has melted and the snow is coming back, and that will hopefully all be gone by the time you return.
Let's hope so.
All right, so 2018 is the 50th anniversary of 1968. What many historians and other people think is one of the most consequential and interesting years in American history. And so what we thought we'd do today is talk about 1968 and think about what its legacy has been. And Frank, I think probably the best way to sort of think about 68, I know many of our listeners are probably familiar with some of the major events, but it might make sense to sort of do this chronologically. What do you think the first really big historic event in 1968 would be?
And one thing we should say is, although we arrived at this idea independently of the New York Times. The New York Times ran a story the other day about 1968 and the 50th anniversary of 1968, and so many of our listeners may have heard that. Mm. And that in the Times piece, one of the contrasts they drew between then and now is the prominence of social media, and so they, as part of that feature, and I commend it to people, they released a series of tweets, because of course we live in the Twitterverse now. They live tweeted 1968 effectively, or historically tweeted 1968. So they too took it chronologically, although in Twitter form. I guess the first big event at the beginning of the year is the Tet Offensive in Vietnam. And 16,000 Americans were killed in Vietnam in 1968, far more Vietnamese, of course. Mm. The Tet Offensive was a real turning point in the war because the North Vietnamese, the Viet Cong, demonstrated their ability to attack the United States and the South Vietnamese regime in a sustained way that was really quite shocking, I think, to a lot of Americans. And 1968 was really a turning point in the Vietnam War in a lot of respects. And we're going to talk about politics in the course of our discussion in the next few minutes, but certainly the 1968 election and a lot of the domestic developments in the United States in 1968 were a response to the events in Vietnam, and the Tet Offensive really starts that.
Tet, for those listeners who aren't familiar with it, is the Vietnamese New Year. It's sort of the big annual holiday there. I've heard it described as being like Christmas, New Year's, and the 4th of July sort of rolled into one. So it's a time in which, there's lots of people celebrating and moving around. And what the Viet Cong were able to do during the Tet Offensive was they're able to effectively infiltrate the cities in South Vietnam and simultaneously attack American fortifications there. And what's important about the Tet Offensive, I think ultimately, I'm curious your thoughts about this, Frank, but that, the narrative up to that point of U.S. involvement in Vietnam was that the United States was winning the war. The United States was effectively able to fight both the Viet Cong and the communist North Vietnamese, and that everything was going smoothly. And I think what the Tet Offensive demonstrated was that the war was not going as well as the Johnson administration was letting on.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it was, it was quite clear. To some extent, the Tet Offensive epitomized the American war in Vietnam more generally. In the course of a month or so, because although the Americans and their South Vietnamese allies were able to kind of respond militarily to kind of counterattack, if you will, Tet and the Tet offensive, the Tet offensive, demonstrated the degree to which the North Vietnamese and their allies in the South appreciated that the war was a political struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, it was the proverbial, this is the cliche is about hearts and minds, both the hearts and minds of people in Vietnam, but also the hearts and minds of people in the United States. And the Vietnam War was not as much a military struggle as a struggle for opinion in those two countries, which came at a very, very bloody cost, of course.
Sure.
And I think Tet demonstrated that American military might alone would not be would not allow the United States to succeed in Vietnam.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. That, you know, there had been protests of the Vietnam War prior to 68, but I think one of the things that Tet did is it, you know, broadened the scope of those protests and made many people who had been relatively uncritical of U.S. involvement, at least much more skeptical. There's a famous photo that was published in the aftermath of the Tet Offensive of a South Vietnamese officer executing a captured member of the Viet Cong that was on the front pages of all the newspapers, and it's sort of a summary execution. I think I'll post a link to the photo in the show notes, and it's images like that and the sort of ways in which Vietnam was on, not only in the newspapers, but was on television. You know, the war looked very different in the aftermath of Tet than it did beforehand.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. And, you know, that image is an iconic image from the war, but it became very difficult in the aftermath of that image and the broader events that produced it to argue that the United States and its allies were necessarily fighting for democratic values.
You know, and I think that the Tet Offensive really, you know, in some ways shaped 1968 is, of course, an election year, and the, you know, ways in which Americans' eyes were opened by the Tet Offensive really fundamentally shaped the election year to come. Lyndon Johnson, of course, is running for re-election. He's running for re-election largely based on the success of the Great Society programs, but also on what had been pitched as a successful foreign policy that now looks that much more difficult to defend in the aftermath of Tet.
That's right. That's right.
You know, one of the things you see that's very interesting about 68 is, you know, usually when you have a sitting president, the primaries within his own party tend to be uncontested and fairly uninteresting. And one of the things that makes 68 interesting, I think, is you have Johnson's, you have his election contested within the Democratic primary, first by Eugene McCarthy in the New Hampshire primary, which of course is the first primary. What do you want to say to me about how we're supposed to make sense of who Eugene McCarthy was and what his candidacy meant?
I don't know what to add, really, David, except to say that, of course, McCarthy's challenge was, you know, as you said, it's very rare for a sitting president to be challenged within his own party. And McCarthy represented that challenge. He also represented, if you will, the political expression of, or the kind of electoral expression of the growing anti-war movement, especially within the Democratic Party. There had been a consensus about the war in the United States. I mean, people forget this because we think of the 60s as this period of rebellion. I think 68 is important because this 1968 is kind of when the 60s become the 60s to some extent. It's relatively late. And McCarthy represents a shattering of that consensus about the war, which had been largely supported by both Democrats and Republicans to that point. But the anti-war movement within the Democratic Party is very, very large, by 1968, and that finds expression in the McCarthy movement, and the support for McCarthy, and I think that's really significant. And of course, Johnson's presidency will come to an end because of this.
And the thing that's interesting about McCarthy is, you know, before the Tet Offensive, he's a relatively, at least among sort of power players in the Democratic Party, he's not one of them, right? He's sort of a relatively minor figure. He's not particularly well known. He's not a particularly great candidate in terms of the sort of door-to-door campaigning, but he becomes the vehicle for people who are, especially young people who are hostile to the Vietnam War. And when they have the Democratic primary in New Hampshire, Johnson continues to win the primary, but McCarthy does well enough that it's clear that Johnson's grip on the party, that everyone had assumed that he would sort of ride his way to the nomination in 68 unimpeded, that was challenged. And that opens the door, of course, for Robert Kennedy to enter the race right after the New Hampshire primary. And Robert Kennedy, of course, was, had been his brother's attorney general, had been senator from New York, and was really seen as the other sort of giant of the Democratic Party. And for Kennedy to enter the race and challenge Johnson, I think really created a interesting debate within, the Democratic leadership about whether the United States was going to try to continue the effort in Vietnam along the track it had been, or whether they were going to try to, some other approach.
That's right. That's right. And of course, we're going to get to the fate that befell Robert Kennedy in 1968 at the end of at the end of that campaign, or the end of that campaign to win the nomination.
Yeah. But one of the things that happens, when Kennedy enters the race, he enters it in mid-March, and by the end of March, Johnson decides that he's not going to seek re-election, which I think is indicative of. This is one of those years, I think, where we often tell students, like, don't worry about the dates. Dates aren't that important. Focus on the big themes. I think this is one of those years where the actual sequence of events really matters a great deal, and actually sort of looking at the ways in which these things relate to one another chronologically, hugely matters. You can imagine if, had the Tet Offensive happened at a different point in the year, it would have meant something very different in terms of its impact on American politics and other things.
Well, that's right. I mean, so you get the Tet Offensive at the very beginning of the year. McCarthy does well in New Hampshire. Robert Kennedy enters the race more or less as a consequence of those two events. Mm-hmm. And by the end of March, Lyndon Johnson, as the sitting president of the United States, who should have been in a position of real political strength, at least to secure the nomination of his party, which should have been a kind of pro forma exercise, has withdrawn from the race.
Yeah, and when you consider, Johnson 4 years earlier, when, he's running in 1964, won in a landslide against Barry Goldwater, and I think that shows you how quickly the sort of political currents are shifting in 68. So Johnson drops out at the end of March. Early April, of course, is a very different story, because one of the things that happens on the 4th of April is that Martin Luther King is assassinated. And I think this is an interesting time to talk about that, because we're having the 50th anniversary of King's assassination is coming up, but we just had Martin Luther King Day earlier this week. And one of the things that struck me, and one of the things I'm interested to see this year, is how people talk about King's assassination in a few months when we have the 50th anniversary, because the King that was killed in 1968 was very different, I think, than the person who has been sort of elevated in American popular culture, and the kind of King that necessarily gets celebrated in rather bland Martin Luther King Day celebrations sometimes.
Well, we just had Martin Luther King Day this week, and it was very, very interesting because, of course, that holiday came right in the aftermath of President Trump's comments with regard to the immigration debate about so-called shithole countries in Africa, as well as and he said disparaging things about Haiti and El Salvador in that meeting, and the interpretation, the kind of spin that emerged earlier this week, at least among some of President Trump's defenders, was how dare you bring up race on Martin Luther King Day, which was a little let's just call it interesting, which was quite an interesting pivot. It was as if to say this is inappropriate, this was against what Dr. King stood for, which was people coming together, and indeed Dr. King did stand for that. And one of the things I saw on Twitter earlier this week in the aftermath of all this suggested that one of the problems or challenges that Americans face in assessing King's legacy is the assumption that the only thing King ever did was the March on Washington in 1963, giving the I Have a Dream speech, which is about Americans coming together. As you know, in 1968, or by 1968, when King is assassinated, he was talking, and he always spoke about social justice, but he was becoming much more explicit in criticizing class divisions in the United States and poverty in the United States. In fact, the King's critics within the FBI, certainly J. Edgar Hoover, asserted that King was a communist. And you're quite right, David. I think this was the implication of your statement a moment ago, that this aspect of King's legacy has really been downplayed or forgotten. And now again, I think those Trump supporters who were invoking King as a shield to Trump earlier this week were just brazen and ahistorical, as they usually are. But I think it suggests a kind of larger trend, almost to make King palatable to older white Americans, that there's a kind of de-emphasis on the social justice aspects of King's personal philosophy and actions, and a greater emphasis on his belief that Americans of all races should sort of come together in harmony.
You know, the thing that struck me, I mean, there's a couple of things about that people, I think, forget about King in 68. I mean, one is he's, you know, they've passed the Civil Rights Act in 64, they passed the Voting Rights Act, but King is very much concentrating on questions about poverty, about economic dislocation, about more radical, one might argue, as you noted, socialist elements. He's also come out against the Vietnam War.
That's right. Yep. So we're back to the way everything overlaps in this year.
And so King has, you know, is presenting a very radical position, both, you know, politically, socially, in other ways. And of course, he was always a radical, but, you know, he's pushing the envelope beyond, I think, you know, some of the quotes you see on Twitter by people who try to quote him out of context. You know, the other thing that I think that's worth pointing out with that I think that's relevant with some of the ways in which he gets misused today is that King was not universally popular during his lifetime. He was not universally, you know, lots of people, lots of white Americans actively disliked King and saw him as a problem. And even you see this after his assassination. The governor of Georgia, after his assassination, called him an enemy of the people. And, you know, in some ways almost praised his assassination. Ronald Reagan, you know, makes a very weird statement after King's... Reagan, at that point, is the governor of California. He makes a very weird statement about King's assassination where he almost blames King for his own assassination. And so there's ways in which, you know, the...
Well, William F. Buckley wrote something in the National Review that was very similar in the aftermath of King's assassination as well. Basically blamed King's death on King.
You know, and so I think it's a, you know, there's a lot of historical amnesia that goes on with King, where some people today try to sort of distill him into, I think, as you point out, like the "I Have a Dream" speech, and even then they only look at half of it. And
that's right.
And he has a much more sort of complicated evolution of his thought over time that people aren't really reckoning with. And in the aftermath of his assassination, of course, in 1968, one of the things that happens is there are riots throughout the United States in a number of cities. You know, there are protests, march, but there's actually also active, riots in Washington, D.C., in Baltimore, in Chicago, in New York City, and other places, in which African-Americans are looking at the King assassination and saying, you know, there's this debate going on over whether nonviolence or more sort of militancy is the route to go. And they're seeing, well, here's the outcome of nonviolence is violence. One of the things that looks like it's happening in the summer of, or in the spring, I guess, of 1968, is it looks like, you know, the kind of social order is starting to unwind. That, you know, the protest marches against the Vietnam War are happening, the protest marches and riots in the aftermath of the King assassination are happening, and these are happening in such, I think, close conjunction with one another, that it's, you know, difficult to sort of see your way out of this. You have the Black Panthers in Oakland engaging in shootouts with police in the aftermath of the King assassination. So it's a fairly, you know, contentious social landscape.
Well, it's not just that, David. It's very, very violent.
Yes.
I mean, and I know you know this, but, you know, there's a tendency in the present moment to think we haven't been here before, and this moment is the most polarized political moment we've ever seen in American history. And of course, that's not true. The level of violence that was employed in 1968 is quite considerable. I mean, you have the murder of a major civil rights leader, and of course, and unfortunately, that had happened throughout the course of the civil rights movement, mm-hmm. but really the major civil rights leader, and that was followed by what can very well be seen as a series of uprisings among African Americans as an oppressed minority in the United States. But the amount of violence deployed by the state in response to those riots and disturbances, mm-hmm. and that uprising is substantial. So I'm talking about police violence and in some cases the National Guard being used. And the amount, the number of deaths and property damage really was unprecedented to that time in American history. There had been race riots, of course, before in American history, going back to the 19th century and in the early 20th century. But in terms of scale and scope, this was unprecedented. And frankly, and thankfully, I guess one should say, or I think one should say, which we haven't seen since.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah. The Los Angeles riots in 1992 were huge, but they were pretty much confined to Los Angeles, whereas this was a series of riots across the United States, and the amount of, the number of people killed, but also the damage to property was unprecedented before or since. And I think just the degree to which 1968 is a year of violence, and, you know, we're not done with it yet, of course, in our discussion, is something to bear in mind. So you have mass violence going on, of course, in Vietnam in that year, and you have violence going on in the streets of the United States as well. It's a profoundly violent year. It's a year where the politics of the gun was very much could be said to characterize what was going on in America.
Without a doubt. All right, so for sort of, you know, the it's sometimes hard to sort of pull apart all these important pieces, because, I mean, April, in the same month that King is assassinated, you also have, you know, protests emerging in other places. You've got students at Columbia, for instance, taking over administration buildings. and basically shutting down the university. You've got Vietnam War protests happening across the country.
Sorry, David, and if I can just add to that,
yeah.
One of the things to bear in mind about 1968, and this is a very interesting moment internationally, is the student protest movement was international. So, one gets, there are massive protests in France, but particularly Paris, and the generation of 1968 very much came to characterize, it's kind of a landmark in French cultural and political history, and of course we get the Prague Spring in 1968 as well. So there's a kind of broader, particularly student-led movement, questioning and rebelling against the established political order, not just in the United States, although most profoundly in the United States, but also elsewhere. We need to bear that in mind. Sorry,
No, I think that's a great, because I mean, I think one of the, this is an international moment, and one of the, you know, the France is, you know, they're having huge strikes in France, student-led uprising. In London, you talked about the U.S. Embassy in our episode last week. Huge protests in March in front of the U.S. Embassy in London, in which hundreds of people are injured. Really profound anger by the British people, especially young people, against U.S. involvement in Vietnam growing out of what's happening in the Tet Offensive and other things. So it looks like not only is the United States struggling militarily in Vietnam more than they thought, but the ways in which the United States' image internationally is being projected is, under threat and really contentious, and obviously factoring all the things that are going on domestically. But there's some other things that are going on. Here's something that I didn't realize. Also happens the first week of April, the same week that King is shot. 2001, A Space Odyssey comes out that week, as does Planet of the Apes.
All right. You know, one of my favorite films.
And just trying to think like what all that means happening in a 3-day period, that 2001, which is about an interesting kind of future, Planet of the Apes, another interesting kind of future, and then King's assassination. How do you fit that into, you know, Hair opens in April of 1968, so there's a ways in which this is a profoundly important cultural moment.
For you in May, Johnny Cash's Live at Folsom Prison was released. It was recorded in January 13th of 1968, but it was released by Columbia Records in May. And I mean, that's a landmark live recording. It's a fabulous live recording that's really stood the test of time well. And of course, Cash went to Folsom Prison because of his song Folsom Prison Blues. But it was interesting because he had a great deal of sympathy for convicts and people who had been kind of victims of the system, as it were. But the kind of tone of that album is very, very interesting as well. So there's that line in Folsom Prison Blues when Cash says, you know, I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. And the convicts cheer.
Yeah,
and according to some accounts of that that concert, you know, Cash and his bandmates sort of looked at each other like, "What the hell have we gotten ourselves into?" But to some extent, that cheer about killing somebody just to watch them die, to some extent, is a really kind of captures the zeitgeist of 1968. The sense of anarchy in and that line was written a decade before, or more than a decade before. But I'm glad you brought up the cultural question, because there's a lot going on in popular culture at the same time, and in popular music, of course, but and film. It's a really it's a very interesting year.
Yeah. So, you know, getting back to sort of the politics of all this, because, you know, one of the things that emerges in the aftermath of the King assassination is now it looks like Bobby Kennedy is going to be sort of the heir apparent for the Democratic nomination. Kennedy gives a very interesting speech the day of King's assassination. I believe he's in Indianapolis, and his campaign team, you know, has just heard about the assassination, doesn't particularly want him to go out and give a speech because he's worried about violence or something. But he goes and he talks about his brother's assassination and how important that was to him, and how, you know, he wants to follow both in King's legacy and in his brother's legacy. You know, he goes to King's funeral and all these things. And, you know, it appears throughout, you know, May that the result of the election is going to be Robert Kennedy's election. But then on June the 5th, and just after winning the California primary and basically locking up the nomination, he's assassinated when he's shot by Sirhan Sirhan in Los Angeles, which, you know, two assassinations of that level within a 2-month period, you know, really, I think, caused many people to question really, you know, how stable American politics were, how stable American society was. And really threw the political door open in all kinds of ways.
I'm here in Sweden at the moment, and one of the things I'm doing is helping to clear my in-laws' house, and I came across something that they had set aside, which was a newspaper from June of 1968 that they kept. And it was a Swedish newspaper, and it was a tabloid, Expressen, which is one of the big newspapers here in Sweden. And it on that day in June of 1968, the headline was simply two words: Kennedy dead, with a huge picture of Robert Kennedy.
Mm.
And that was the entire front page of the newspaper. And so that was a really kind of, I think, shocking moment for people, especially in the wake of King's assassination.
Yeah.
I think if you were a progressive in the United States or a liberal in the United States in 1968, and two of the most iconic and important leaders of your political movement were killed in a couple of months, that would indeed be shocking.
Yeah.
I mean, and Kennedy's assassination, of course, had dramatic consequences for the presidential race, because, as you say, he was basically locking down the Democratic nomination at that point. He just won the California primary when he was assassinated. And so, of course, I assume we're going to get to this in a minute.
Yeah.
Or so, Hubert Humphrey, the vice president from Minnesota, would be nominated as the Democratic nominee instead of Kennedy. Now, the election of 1968, Richard Nixon would win that.
Mm.
He may well have won, because Nixon claimed he had a secret plan to win the Vietnam War. He may well have won anyway. But he would have faced a much more difficult time, I think, against Bobby Kennedy than he did against Hubert Humphrey.
No doubt. So I want to remind people about, you know, Nixon gets the nomination in, I guess, early August of 68, the Republican convention in Miami. You know, Nixon in some ways had tried to sort of reinvent himself. He had, of course, had this important political career in the 1950s as vice president. He had run for president in 1960, had lost very narrowly to John Kennedy. He had run for governor of California in 62 and loses that election. But he comes back as in 68, in some ways as a, senior politician, somebody who had a wealth of experience. He runs very much on a law and order platform, which has all kinds of coded language in it for race relations.
Yes, and in so doing, he's certainly making a statement about all that rioting that occurred in the spring and the summer,
mm-hmm.
And the unrest among African Americans in response to King's killing. So
mm-hmm.
You're absolutely right, David. Law and order is code for, one could say white supremacy, but certainly it's a code for using the power of the state to put black people in their place.
You know,
would you agree with that? I think
that's what Nixon's, you know, he's projecting both his experience. He claims he's got this secret plan for Vietnam, which of course he doesn't have. or maybe he does and it just didn't work. You know, it, but he is trying to project stability, whereas the Democrats are, as we'll see in, when we talk about the convention in Chicago, demonstrating instability, if nothing else.
That's right. I mean, but with Nixon wrapping himself in the mantle of law and order, and if, even if we, if you don't want to, if one doesn't want to go so far as to say it's a coded statement about white supremacy, and I think we would both say that, but you could say it's a way of saying the Democrats stand for lawlessness and disorder.
Yes.
Even if you take race out of the equation, I don't think you can, but even if you did, you know, that law and order, it's also, it's not very coded language aimed at white Southerners who, as we talked about a few weeks ago, have historically been Democrats, but now are up for grabs because of the civil rights movement and the Democrats, in some cases, reluctant embrace of civil rights and the Voting Rights Act. And so Nixon is a canny politician and analyst. He recognizes that white Southerners, you know, are now up for grabs. And this is the beginning of the pivot of the white South away from the Democratic Party into the Republican Party. And Nixon helped make that happen because for all of his deficiencies, Nixon was a very canny politician in many ways.
No doubt. We need to talk about Chicago because, you know, the place for me where 68 becomes 68 is at the Democratic Convention in Chicago. And, you know, I used to be a high school teacher, and the part I always love to teach about this is trying to sort of make sense of what's happening at both in the convention hall in Chicago in 68 and what's happening outside the convention hall.
So David, give us your teacher's version of that then. How would you present that to a class?
Well, I mean, I think what you have in, you know, what people saw at Chicago was this was going to be a place to talk about, you know, the future of liberal democracy in America. That this was going to be the place where the future of the civil rights movement is going to be decided. This is the place where the future of the free speech movement is going to be decided. This is going to be the place where the future of the Vietnam War is going to be decided. And so everybody who is interested in those kinds of questions on the left, I think, converged upon Chicago as a site where they could hope, try to influence both the convention, but also sort of the national dialogue on these questions. And so you've got, you know, Democratic activists, but you've also got people like students from a Democratic society showing up in huge numbers. You're having the Black Panthers show up. You've got the, you know, fringe movements like the Yippies, the Youth International Party, show up. You know, and they converge upon Chicago, you know, and most of them are on sort of the outskirts of, you know, they're not in the convention hall itself. And what you have going on in the convention hall is a, sort of a similar fight between different wings of the Democratic Party, between the Johnson wing, and of course Johnson's, you know, not running for re-election, but he's sort of de facto running for re-election through Hubert Humphrey, and the more liberal wing of the Democratic Party, the Robert Kennedy wing, if you will, who of course isn't there because he was assassinated a couple months beforehand, but he's being sort of supported, being sort of evoked by the Eugene McCarthy fans who are supporters who are still there on the ground in the convention hall. And so you have this, you know, fight, both a literal and metaphorical fight going on within the convention hall and going on outside the convention hall. And of course, all of this is being televised. And so it's a way in which I think the politics of it is enormously dramatic. And I think this is one of those moments, you know, we think about conventions today and conventions today. Most conventions are immensely boring, you know, which, you know, that they're political theater. With little consequence.
Unbelievably dull political theater.
Yeah. This is, you know, Chicago was a time in which the convention mattered. and really in some ways shaped not only the outcome of that election, I think, but really shaped the entire year and shaped American politics for decades to come.
Well, indeed. And one of the reasons we have dull conventions now is because of 1968 in Chicago. No political party wants to be seen to be associated with such scenes of disorder.
I know the Democrats had, like, for a long time, didn't have their convention in Chicago precisely because they didn't want this to be evoked. And eventually, I think, you know, 8 years ago they did. But, you know, the.
No, I was going to endorse what you said, but also observe that basically, there were, as you say, this happened on two levels. There was the struggle within the convention, and then there were the scenes in the streets, which kind of epitomized the division in the country at the time. Because, of course, Chicago politically was then and remains to this day a heavily Democratic city. But the mayor of Chicago, Mayor Daley, was a kind of old-fashioned Democrat who had no time for a kind of long-haired, dope-smoking hippies. And unleashed the police on them. And to some extent, what you saw was almost kind of working-class union Democrats pitted against hippies and liberals and so on. And what played out on television, on people's television screens, was a kind of, if you will, civil war within the Democratic Party.
Yes.
But what, in the aftermath of Nixon, say, you know, who was, as you say, a well-established political figure in the United States at this point, who said he was standing up for law and order, and as I said to you a few minutes ago, the opposite of that is lawlessness and disorder, and the Democratic Convention seemed to be nothing more than a mass demonstration of lawlessness and disorder on people's TV screens.
You actually
against the backdrop of all the other events we've talked about up to that point in the year. And it's not all that surprising that the public opted for the Republicans in November.
No, it's not. You know, there are fights breaking out on the convention floor. There's a police riot taking place outside the convention. You know, and all of this is being televised. And I think it made the Democratic Party look chaotic and almost anarchist, you know, without a central focus or direction, you know, all of which I think opened the door for Nixon's victory.
And let's not forget, LBJ is still the president.
Yes.
He's the titular head of the party, but he's decided not to run because he's so unpopular. The war in Vietnam is continuing to go on its bloody pace. And Bobby Kennedy is dead, and poor Hubert Humphrey's been nominated. Hubert Humphrey was a very good politician and a very good public servant, but it was an almost impossible task for him to win under such circumstances, I think.
Without a doubt, you know. And thinking about all the other things that are going on in the midst of all this, we've got the 68 Olympics in Mexico City, which, you know,
In October,
right, which is, you know, has lots of interesting things that happen there, but probably the one that's most politically significant is in the aftermath of the 200-meter race. You know, two black American athletes raise their fists in a Black Power salute.
John Carlos and Tommy Smith.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, there's ways in which the politics of 68 is infusing all of these things that are going on around it.
And that was what, you know, that was obviously occurred on television. It was very, very controversial and unpopular. Happened only a few weeks before the election. We've seen echoes of this. We talked about this a couple of months ago in the context of the Colin Kaepernick's protests and the protests within the NFL in particular during the national anthem. But to some extent, that movement got its start with the 1968 Olympics John Carlos and Tommy Smith's protest. I think that had a direct bearing on the election as well. Although to some extent, it summed up everything that was going on in that year rather than as much as anything, I guess.
Oh, to be sure. And if I just want to pick one other event from that year to point out as in my mind, just sort of typifying some of the ways in which this is a pivotal year. At the end of the year, you have, in December, Apollo 8 become the first manned spacecraft to leave Earth orbit and orbit the moon. And one of the things that happens in Apollo 8 is the picture, it's usually called Earthrise, taken yep. by William Anders on Christmas Eve, of the Earth rising over the surface of the moon. You know, one of the ways in which that picture has been interpreted, one of the ways people have thought about that is it you know, in a world that's very deeply divided, you know, in the Cold War context, divided among class and racial lines, the ways in which the entire Earth is, you know, looks like a little marble in space, to use Anders's words there. You know, I think that sort of touched off in much of the sort of environmental movement, the ways in which you think about the Earth as a solitary whole.
That's right, and it's a beautiful image and a fragile image. Yeah. And I think we should also remember note that the other two members of that crew were Frank Borman and James Lovell, mm. who were named Time Magazine's Men of the Year that year. So Time tried to end on a positive note, I think, in light of everything that had happened in 1968. We should back up and just say that, of course, in November, Richard Nixon won an overwhelming, not quite a landslide, but an overwhelming victory in the November election. Mm. So David, it's a tumultuous year. It begins with the Tet Offensive. It ends with Apollo 8. And, of course, that's kind of a hopeful note, if you will, and it's going to anticipate the moon landing the following summer. What do we make of all this? I mean, the skeptical part of me wants to say, you know what? The baby boomers are the most narcissistic generation in American history. and this is their year of crisis, so we have to keep hearing about it. And surely there were other years like this in American history. I mean, you're a historian of the Civil War. 1861's a pretty big year. 1865's a big year. 1877's a big year in your period. I'm a historian of the American Revolution. You know, 1776, kind of an important year. 1789, kind of important year. Yes. But we don't have people wittering on for 50 years after, you know, about it. So,
I don't know. I think you did in 1776 have people blathering about it for years afterwards.
Actually, that's true. Okay, but could we not say that 1776 is like 1968, for example? So notwithstanding that we've, you know, we've tortured our poor listeners for the past, you know, 40 minutes or so about this, is 1968 really as important as all that?
I think it is, and one of the ways in which I think 68, I mean, I think first 68 has shaped American politics in the 50 years since. I think it's really a pivot point where, you know, if you look at American politics between, you know, especially since 1933 with the New Deal all the way through, you know, Lyndon Johnson's Great Society programs and the Civil Rights Movement, there's a progressive characteristic to American politics for that 35-year period. And what you see in the 50 years afterwards, I think, is a very conservative, or at least a conservative, mode of American politics that starts with Richard Nixon and really continues in some ways until today. That you know, even when you've had Democrats elected into the White House, you haven't had that kind of ambitious progressive agenda that you saw with FDR or with LBJ. And so I think it really does change American politics in a really fundamental way. We're still living in its shadow. The other way in which I think 68 is interesting, and I think this is coming up in our discussion this episode, is that when we think about those other pivotal years, when we think about 1776 or when we think about 1861 or 1877 or whatever date you want to pick, you know, usually we remember those dates for, you know, either one event or a series of related events. You know, when we think about 1776, we have a very clear image of what that means and what that year signifies. 68, I think, is interesting because it has this confluence of a number of different related but, you know, at the same time, very, very different elements. You know, so the, it's an interesting moment in the history of the civil rights movement. It's an interesting moment in the history of Vietnam. It's an interesting moment in politics and in popular culture, you know. And so there's ways in which, you know, the stars are aligning or misaligning, if you will, in 68 that makes it, I think, different.
Okay, you persuaded me. We should single it out.
I don't okay.
You know, whether it's the most momentous year in American history or not, you're right. It's certainly a very, very full year. There's a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, I think you can. I mean, one can, and people do teach entire courses on 68 because it does really allow you to explore, you know, lots of different features of American society, you know, including lots of things we didn't get a chance to talk about today.
That's right. I mean, one of the things that will that's worth doing, if you have a look at the New York Times article from earlier this week on 1968, actually the fact that they are tweeting, that they presented as a series of tweets, is very, very interesting because it does give you a sense for just the speed and pace and the of events in that year and just how many things were happening in so many different areas. So, okay, I'm persuaded.
All right. Time for last drops, Frank. What you got?
Well, this relates to what we've been talking about to a certain extent. As we said earlier this week was Martin Luther King Day on Monday, and our fellow historian, colleague and friend, Honor Sachs, who's a historian of your period, David,
yes.
Made a very interesting tweet earlier in the week. She tweeted out, she shared a tweet from the King Center, and it was a copy of Dr. King's handwritten syllabus for a social philosophy course that he taught at Morehouse College in Atlanta, historically black college in Atlanta, in 1961-62. And it's interesting to me, it's a wonderful document, but it's interesting to me because, of course, at least for ourselves and our colleagues in the Northern Hemisphere, this week marked not only Martin Luther King Day, but also the beginning of the semester for many of us. And it was nice to see that Dr. King did what we all do and, you know, was putting his syllabus together and began with a pad of legal paper, seemingly, and then wrote out, you know, starting with Plato and going down to Jeremy Bentham. And it's a great document, and I'm grateful to Honor for calling it to our attention.
Great.
What do you have, David?
Well, I've got two things I want to endorse. One is, you know, speaking of sort of live tweeting things, Columbia later this year is going to be live tweeting the 50th anniversary of the protests on Columbia's campus and the occupation of their administration building, since they're going to be drawing upon documents in their archives to share those with people in real time, or at least in 50th anniversary real time, later this spring. So I want to endorse the Twitter feed for that. That's at 1968CU. And the other piece I want to endorse is also in some ways connects with 1968 in interesting ways. And it's an article by Claire Potter, who teaches at the New School in New York. An article about free speech on campus today. And it's a really, I think, thoughtful piece about, you know, some of the difficulties that universities are having trying to figure out what the boundaries of free speech on campus should look like in the age of Trump, how to make sense of, you know, sometimes very provocative speakers on the left and on the right, and also how to make sense of, you know, free speech in the classroom, in which, you know, many students feel that their political views may or may not be welcome in the classroom, and how to talk to students who may have different political views than you do. you know, and she talks quite eloquently about, she's a very progressive liberal thinker, but she often sometimes has conservative students, and she talks very eloquently about how she addresses, you know, those political differences in the classroom in meaningful ways. So I want to endorse her article on campus free speech wars.
Excellent.
Great. So next week, Frank, you'll be here in person, and we can do this again. Till then,
excellent.
Next time.
Okay, David.
Cheers.
Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.